they give the person the benefit of the doubt to such an extent that the data are often reassuring to someone who shouldn't be reassured. We agree with Don Beck, who told us that getting around this problem requires trusted advisors and tools that use forced rankings rather than simple statements that the respondent agrees with or not. If you're motivated to see what people really think, make sure the process will give you the truth. Learn business, but without the me focus in most university degree programs. Unless people are focused and intentional, they may graduate from a professional program such as law, business, or medicine as stage 3 performers who use a few stage 4 words, such as vision and values. This is true for two reasons. First, professors, like most professionals, tend to operate at stage 3, with research and teaching done as individuals. Promotion decisions are made mostly on the basis of individual performance, so people who adopt the single performer mentality do well. Second, one of the core limitations of stage 3 is that knowledge is equated with power. So giving someone at stage 3 an MBA, JD, PhD, or MD is like giving an executioner a sharper sword. A way to be better and to cut down others' success as less than theirs. What moves people from stage 3 is the set of epiphanies in the next chapter. When combined with the knowledge from a top degree program, the results can be world-changing. The best tribal leaders we met are highly educated individuals whose identity is not the letters after their name or a license hanging on the wall. Many around them were surprised to learn that they had advanced degrees because they never brought it up. Telling people you think they're at stage 3 can be career-threatening. Many listeners of this book will recognize stage 3 in someone around them. Herein lies the danger. If you point out that he is stage 3, especially if he is in the early or middle portions, he may deny the charge and become angry, seemingly out of proportion to the charge. As we'll hear in Chapter 7, many people at Stage 3 think they're at Stage 5. So, what do you do? One approach is to give him a copy of this book with a note to read this and the next chapter. Network with other people who share your aspirations. We offer many resources to help you free of charge, to connect you to other readers in telephone conversations, in-person meetings, and through online resources. Visit our website, triballeadership.net, for more information and to join the community. Find a mentor at Stage 4. One of our readers recently wrote to us, "The Stage 4 mentors I have been blessed to know over the years have really made a difference in my life. They've certainly helped me to move beyond some of my Stage 3 tendencies." You might come to the same conclusion as many people in our studies, that you are operating at Stage 3, and while it's important to take pride in your accomplishments, maybe the costs of staying at "I'm great" are outweighing the benefit. When people see that their behavior tends to peg others at Stage 2, they look around with a new pair of eyes. One manager in South Asia told us, "I'm surprised to see that people around me are more gifted and special than I thought." A New York financial executive said with a smile, "People aren't the idiots I thought they were." An ex-union president, whom we'll meet in the next chapter, said, "I saw that I wasn't making an impact and that the people I thought were my enemies should have been my partners." Make the person aware that she's using management rather than leadership. People at Stage 3 approach leadership as though it were a set of tasks they could check off their to-do list. For example, set the vision, get alignment, and listen with intention. The moment leadership becomes cookie cutter, it isn't leadership at all. It's management. By making the person aware that he's behaving in a stage 3 fashion toward leadership, you might help him see that he isn't a leader at all. This realization may propel him into the set of epiphanies of the next chapter. When you begin to see other people's insightful nature and unique gifts, they look like people worth developing, learning from, and leading. This perspective is your launching pad for the epiphanies that will bring you to stage 4, the zone of tribal leadership. Summary of Stage 3. The person at Stage 3 is connected to others in a series of dyadic two-person relationships. The language of this stage expresses, "I'm great," and in the background, unstated, is, "And you're not." When people at Stage 3 cluster together, they attempt to outperform each other on an individual basis and put each other down. Although this is often done under the veil of humor, the effect is the same. Each is striving for dominance. Individuals' behavior expresses a lone warrior ethos, and collectively, the culture becomes the Wild Wild West. Leveraging points for a person at Stage 3. Encourage him to work on projects that are bigger than anything he can do alone. In short, assign him work that requires partnership. Point out that his success has come through his own efforts, but that the next level of success is going to require a totally different style. In other words, show him that what's brought him to this point will not be enough to move him forward. Describe role models, ideally in the company, that are exhibiting Stage 4 behavior. You'll know these individuals by 1. Their focus on we, 2. The number of triads, 3-person relationships, explained in Chapter 10, in their networks, and 3. Success that comes from groups. When the person complains that he doesn't have time and that the others aren't as good, the two chief gripes at Stage 3, show that he has crafted his work life so that no one can really contribute to him. Tell stories about the time you made the transition from Stage 3 to Stage 4. Coach him that real power comes not from knowledge but from networks, and that there is more leverage in wisdom than in information. Compliment his successes, and they are likely numerous, and emphasize that you're on his side. Also help him to notice that his goals require getting more done than he is able to do alone, no matter how smart and talented he is. Encourage him to manage using transparency as much as possible under corporate policy. Coach him to not follow the Stage 3 tendency to tell them only what they need to know. Rather, encourage him to over-communicate. Encourage him to form triads. Success indicators. He will substitute we language for I. When people ask about the secret of his success, he will point to his team, not to himself. He will actively form triads, and his network will expand from a few dozen to several hundred. He will work less and yet get more done. His complaint about there's not enough time and no one is as good will cease. The results for which he is accountable will increase by at least 30%. He will communicate with transparency. He will communicate more information and more often. Chapter 7. The Tribal Leadership Epiphany. In the years when Richard Nixon was president, Bob Tobias was living the wild world of Stage 3 and loving it. Then, a reporter asked him a simple question that led to a cascade of insights we term the epiphany. After this process, he emerged as a tribal leader. He came to Washington in 1966 to go to law school and never left. While working at the Internal Revenue Service, he learned how labor unions worked, and that became his passion for the next 30 years. He went to work for what is now the National Treasury Employee Union, NTEU, becoming a general counsel in 1970. In a Stage 3 moment of glory, he filed a lawsuit against Richard Nixon for freezing federal employee pay. The suit was dismissed under the case law that a sitting president cannot be sued. Tobias appealed, expecting to lose, and then the famous Nixon tapes surfaced. In a separate case in which NTEU collaborated, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that no one, not even a sitting president, is above the law, and thus can be sued. With that precedent behind him, he eventually won a $533 million judgment against Nixon on behalf of every federal employee. It was an ego hit of the highest order, Tobias told us, and his journey through Stage 3 was just getting started. Today, Tobias is deceptively quiet. He has a small build, bright eyes, and a wide smile with an appearance that conveys the meticulous nature of an attorney who believes that details matter. We met him on a muggy Saturday in Washington, when most people were in t-shirts and shorts. Tobias wore a sport coat and never broke a sweat. The image of a soft-spoken, thoughtful man didn't match his words. I told people that the way to make an impact as a union lawyer is to kick the shit out of them so that they never want to see you again. He referred to himself in the 1970s as a badass who would use any management slip as an excuse to arbitrate a grievance, file an unfair labor practice charge, or begin a lawsuit. By 1975, he managed his 13 employees by directly talking with each person, creating dyads, as described in the last chapter. When the staff doubled in size to 26, Tobias hit the barrier of having only 24 hours in a day, so he appointed regional supervisors in Atlanta, San Francisco, Austin, and Washington. To the frustration of the new managers, he continued to reach out directly to each person. As Tobias told us, they finally confronted me, asking why the hell I had appointed them. He went on, "It was painful for me. I had to give up something I loved, touching each person. But I had no choice." Tobias was working up the management ladder, as many people at Stage 3 do, by turning lessons into new ways to win. From 1970 to 1983, Tobias would fly into a city, arbitrate a grievance or unfair labor practice charge on behalf of one or more union members, usually win, and then leave with the union applause still ringing in his ears. In 1983, the president of the union retired, and Tobias was voted in. Now, running one of the most powerful unions in the federal government, he sat at the big desk. On his first day, he took a call from a reporter, and he still remembers the question. "Now that you've been elected, what are you going to do?" Tobias had no idea. He told us, "I knew what I wanted others to not do, mistreat our members. But what was I going to do?" That was a slap in the face. I couldn't answer the question. Tobias's epiphany was about to begin. The epiphany in a nutshell. Having interviewed thousands of people who have made it into Stage 4, the zone of tribal leadership, we discovered that every person had an awakening. Some called it a major business insight. One said, "In the shower this morning, I realized there's a better way to do business that will mean much higher profitability." Some called it corporate karma. Others described it as a need to live their values. Some came to it after years of psychotherapy or doing a self-help program. Some came to it through what Warren Bennis and Robert Thomas, in Geeks and Geezers, call a crucible experience, an event that causes people to reflect, at both an intellectual and an emotional level, on their core assumptions. For some people, 9/11 kickstarted the epiphany. For most people, the epiphany was actually a series of epiphanies, each presenting a deeper insight about what wasn't working in stage three. While the epiphany happens to all tribal leaders, it may not happen in adulthood. Gordon Binder, former CEO of Amgen, apparently had it growing up in New Mexico and finished it in the Navy. Mike Ruzione, the captain of the 1980 United States Olympic hockey team, had something like the epiphany playing hockey early in his life. Frank Jordan became a tribal leader through the Boys and Girls Clubs. They all described the epiphany as the turning point in their lives, both personally and professionally, regardless of how they came to it or went through it. Although it often took months or years for the epiphany to burble through their minds, once the moment of awareness happened, there was no turning back. They often described it in sound bites. We heard statements like these: "Nothing that matters is personal." "Stage three has no legacy." "To win at stage three is to win small." "I now see I have been a manipulator, not a leader." "I'm tired. Isn't there some other game to play?" "I see myself through others' eyes and I don't like what I see." Many became evangelists for the epiphany but discovered that others weren't swept into life-changing insights with these taglines. What might be going through your mind is what others said in response. "I know that. That's not a big deal." And, "So what?" People who've had this epiphany read books differently, often highlighting sections for others, hoping to spread the insights that change their lives. To them, leadership books that once seemed simple and flat were now richly textured, filled with life-changing words. Books of tips and tools and techniques, once the staple of their reading diet, now strike them as drivel. To people still in stage three, the book of tips is still better, and highlighting sections of a book of platitudes is odd and unhelpful. Our goal in this chapter is for you to be able to lead others through the epiphany the way it happened to several people in our studies. The sequence that Bob Tobias went through is typical, so we'll use it as the backbone of this chapter. Bob emerged as a stage four tribal leader, having far more success than he could have imagined at stage three. Note that throughout our focus is language, not psychology or spirituality. We didn't map why the people in our study changed their concepts and experienced an epiphany or had a shift in their awareness. We didn't measure anything about their spiritual beliefs or practices. Ken Wilber, a world expert on developmental stages in society, author of 24 books and founder of the Integral Institute, told us that these two parts of a human being, her psychology, worldview, spirituality, and her conversations, tend to advance in stages together. Our focus is on what people said and their resulting behavior changes in the tribe. Epiphany, Part 1. What have I achieved? The question the reporter asked Tobias sparked reflection and soul-searching, especially about how he had spent his time in the Union up to that point. A memory that was fresh in his mind was a bitter fight in Chicago, where 300 people picketed the IRS in the middle of winter. As a protest march got underway, he looked at the temperature on a bank thermometer and it read minus 15. He sent out for coffee, and by the time he had distributed it, waiting for the press to arrive, a sheet of ice had covered the pot of coffee. That fight seemed to capture his time with the Union, one bitter battle after another. In thinking about the Chicago fight and many others like it, Tobias says, "It occurred to me that we hadn't done a single thing that would affect how individual supervisors treated people. Not a damn thing. We would go in, win a court victory, and leave. It was an institutional victory, but nothing changed in people's daily lives. I learned to name the thing I was doing that was holding me back," he continued. "Once I could name it, I could do something about it. It was working for versus working with." He realized that his career had been spent working for the union members, which required that he work against the government and its managers. Tobias had always seen the first part of that sentence, that he was an advocate, but he had never before realized that his way of operating required an enemy. He assumed the fight, so he created it wherever he went. It's worth noting that both stages 3 and 4 require an adversary. When we work with people and groups, people in stage 3 groups will say, "I'm great because I sold more last quarter than anyone," or "I just bought a huge house." They begin to notice that these statements are all comparative, netting out to, "I'm better than others." At stage 4, people will say, "We're great because our team is winning," or "We have the best people." Again, this language system implies we're better than them. At 3, the enemy is other individuals. At 4, it's another group, or a company, or even an industry. Only at 5 does the need for an enemy go away, as we'll hear in Chapter 12. There's another part to the epiphany for Tobias, and this was a realization about his own blindness. He said, "I loved winning. I loved being the Lone Ranger. I loved coming into town and slaying the dragon with everyone saying, 'Great job, we needed you.' It was a complete ego hit, so I couldn't see that I wasn't making an impact." Bingo. The Epiphany, Part 1. "When I got it," Tobias said. "And then, I was relentless." Many people told us in exactly these words, "My impact is far less than I thought. I thought I was winning, but it was all about me, and I didn't do a thing that mattered." Almost as the words are forming in their mouths, they begin to say what the solution is, still in stage 3 language. "I will find a way to fix this problem, just as I've handled every other problem in my life, with hard work, talent, and guts." Epiphany Part 2. How can I fix this? Tobias began preaching collaboration, working with rather than working for. He learned about interest-based bargaining, working with a professor from the University of Michigan. The more he preached, the more people ignored him. "I asked my staff why they weren't doing anything differently. And then it became clear. Because I wasn't doing anything differently, I was still the Lone Ranger." As Tobias examined his own behavior, he saw it was similar to what people all around him were doing, including many of the local union presidents. "I realized that they were elected as badasses and that it would be hard to get them to do anything different." Again and again in our studies, people going through the epiphany became aware that stage 3 wasn't working for anyone. In some cases, they see others' shortcomings first. For other people, like Tobias, their own lack of impact came into view first. In every case, they saw that the general system of "I'm great" language and behavior was not achieving success. Although we didn't know Tobias when his epiphany started in 1983, it's likely, in fact, almost certain, that he was saying the stage four words, vision, partnership, and collaboration, but that his sentences were focused on I, me, and my. His recollections in 2006 support what we heard from so many in our study. I was talking facilitation, but my approach was still adversarial. The Integral Institute's Ken Wilber told us that people's awareness, which he terms the cognitive line, always comes before feelings or actions. All developmentalists agree on that, he said. In that case, we're in good company, as our research came to the same conclusion, that people start the move into the epiphany with an awareness of a different way to operate but without any idea how to make it real. Since we were measuring their language, not their psychological state, we noticed that people's discussion of stage four came before their actions. Awareness comes first, and it has always been this way. Wilber commented, Mahatma Gandhi started out with the idea of a free India long before he took the first step to make it free. Jack Welch became aware that the lack of executive collaboration at General Electric was a problem before he had a strategy to deal with it. If this chapter first hits you as a set of ideas, that's exactly how it should start. The coaching is to let the idea create an awareness of how things can be different for you and for others. We described the threshold of stage three and four to former Amgen CEO Gordon Binder. There's a tremendous irony here, he said. When people operate in the I system, they can't have a legacy. When they operate in the we, stage four system, they can have an individual legacy. If you told them that, they probably wouldn't believe it. He's right. And that's what people at this point in the epiphany realize. The challenge for the coach is to nudge the person to see that the system of stage three develops no true followers, hence no legacy. It's not that the person isn't capable of leaving a legacy, she is. It's that the stage in which she is operating isn't designed to do that. The first part of the epiphany is that the person isn't making the impact he thought he was. The second part is that the I, me, my system isn't capable of fixing the problem. The person sees himself as others see him, and they don't like what they see. One of the most remarkable moments in our interviews came with actor Gary Cole, who portrayed Office Space boss Bob Lumberg. Since he is a great actor, he often answered our questions within character, his voice reflecting the passivity of Lumberg, or the spunk of one of his other famous roles, Bob Russell, the vice president on the West Wing. Both characters took criticism for being narrow-minded and blind to their foibles. During one of these moments, when his voice sounded like Russell, we asked what that character's pitfall was. Without a second of hesitation, he said, I don't know that I see an Achilles heel or any weakness. Then he came out of character and a second later said, if they have a weakness, it's that they don't recognize that they have any weaknesses. They don't acknowledge them. Humility isn't high on their chart. He added, Lumberg and Russell have blinders on, and they can only go forward. They have no reverse gear. They have no reflective genes in their body. This moment captures the problem. When in character, when viewing the world through the eyes of someone at stage three, Cole reported no mistakes, no major weaknesses. The moment he took on the language system of stage four, which is how Cole speaks when he's talking about his own life, the pitfalls of his characters were as obvious as Lumberg's trademark coffee mug. Stage three cannot see the effects of its behavior, just as without a mirror you can't see your own eyeballs. As the second part of the epiphany was drawing to a close, Tobias saw the real problem with stage three. It cannot be fixed. it can only be abandoned. Saying, "I will fix this situation," is another form of stage three, like saying, "I'm great because I see myself the way others see me and am working on my legacy." Trying to do so merely creates new blind spots and repeats the stage three cycle. Furthermore, the costs of stage three become increasingly clear. People are, in fact, accomplishing the opposite of what they want. "I was fighting for dignity and respect for federal employees," Tobias said, "and yet his badass behavior wasn't in line with these values at all. He was removing dignity and respect from the system, not adding them." Epiphany Part 3. What's the real goal? The first two parts of the epiphany allow the person to ask a question. What am I really trying to accomplish? Other versions of the question we heard were, what's the point of all this? And how do we know if we're successful? In the midst of this epiphany, people we interviewed had many different goals that are surprisingly similar. David Kelly, the founder and CEO of IDEO, whom we'll get to know in the next chapter, said, "The goal is to hang with friends and to do things greater than any one of us could do alone." George Zimmer, the CEO of Men's Warehouse, made famous on his television commercials saying, "I guarantee it," told us, "The goal of business is that we have fun, and we are dead serious about it. It's even in our corporate bylaws." All of these goals boil down to wanting to make an impact on a large group of people. At this stage of the epiphany, physicians remember that they went to medical school to help people, lawyers that they studied law to protect people's rights, professors became professors to do for others what someone had done for them, kindle a love of learning. In a sense, this third phase of the epiphany brings people back to a simpler time in their lives. They're moving not back but forward, integrating and expanding their original goal with what they learned while they were moving through stage three. As the person sees into her blind spots, she realizes that the ego hit of accomplishment isn't the same as success itself. Her attention shifts to what's really important to her, and almost always, the goal is tribal. David Kelly of IDEO said his goal became hanging out with great people and creating stuff that makes a difference. George Zimmer, CEO of Men's Warehouse, said, "We need to keep thinking about the people in our stores and how to make their lives better." Frank Jordan, the former mayor of San Francisco, whom we met in Chapter 4, is one of the most self-effacing people we met. He now works as special assistant to the president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Gordon Moore is the co-founder of Intel and founder of the foundation. Jordan said of Moore, "So many people are saying me, 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 and Moore is so unassuming, so humble." He says, "We don't need publicity. We're not looking for publicity. We're looking for projects to fund." It's so different from the people I knew in politics. Jordan revealed himself as someone who had the epiphany in saying this about his boss. People still at stage three might have said, "It's great to work with someone who can keep up with me." As the seesaw tilts toward stage four, the person's language and behavior shifts away from I and the dyadic relationships and toward we and networked systems of people. This is the part of the epiphany that is most remarkable to us. Its work is automatic. Tobias said, "It was so obvious I couldn't believe I didn't see it before. The more the group succeeds, the more I succeed." As transformational expert Werner Erhard told us, "Let it use you. Don't try to use it." One of the most moving descriptions of this larger goal came from actor Gary Cole, this time talking about his life, not about his roles. Cole has a daughter with autism, and when he and his wife first heard the diagnosis, they went in search of a tribe to help them. As they talked with parents, medical experts, and people with autism, they became tribal authorities on the subject, using Cole's celebrity to increase awareness and provide support to other families. When we asked him what drove this effort, he answered as if he were saying what everyone knows. If you had to categorize any purpose in the world, it would be to help someone else. What is the reason anyone is here? You can point to having an experience and then someone down the road is in trouble and they're going through what you've survived. And you stick your hand out. If you had to shortly define humanity, that would be it. Once Cole saw the goal, having an impact on people, his behavior was automatic, like getting out of bed in the morning. He was used by it, in Erhard's words. Also notice that his language is not focused on I, me, or my. He is speaking for a tribe of people. Ironically, his epiphany is exactly what the characters he plays, such as Lumberg, need to experience to move to We're Great. They would have to see the goal as clearly as the actor who brought them to life. First, though, they would have to see the effect of their behavior and that they cannot succeed alone. With the goal in place, Tobias's actions fell in line with stage four. He no longer tried to beat up the local union presidents to get their compliance. His staff's complaint that you haven't changed one bit vanished as he spoke with people in the union and in government to look for common ground. He noticed that everyone around him valued dignity and respect, and he began talking about a union that would bring those values to life for everyone in the federal system. Now speaking for thousands of people, not just for himself, Tobias's words carried the weight of a tribal leader. He met with local union presidents and said, "It's not enough to be reactive, to sit behind your desk and wait for management to screw up, which they will, and beat the shit out of them. You have to be more than an insurance policy. You have to represent the 95% who never use any union services." Notice that Tobias now spoke for the people and his language dropped the stage three focus on I. He also found that when he spoke for the tribe, his words carried real weight. Ironically, by dropping the focus on himself, he became stronger. Note that people don't lose ambition, drive, or work ethic by moving to stage four. After the epiphany, Tobias had more personal power, not less. Don Beck, author of Spiral Dynamics, told us, "The old system, stage three, doesn't disappear. The new system, stage four, transcends and subsumes it." In the same way that a glass of water is much more than the individual H2O molecules that make it up, nothing is lost when people move to the next stage. Stage four takes everything that works about stage three and reorganizes it so that the person becomes more powerful. From our experience, people going through the epiphany found that fact reassuring, giving them a stronger vision for what was to come. Ironically, if people attempt to force the epiphany in order to become stronger, it doesn't work. They have to see and feel and know and believe that stage three will not get them to where they want to go. Epiphany Part 4. How does a tribal leader use power? Niccolo Di Bernardo de Machiavelli's life would make a great storyline for a daytime soap opera. He was expelled from his political office when the Medici family came to rule in Florence, Italy in 1494. Desperate to return to politics, he wrote a book many of us should have read in high school, and didn't, The Prince. As the Cliff Notes made clear to us, the authors of this book when we were in college. We were both too busy living the Stage 3 lifestyle to read the actual book. Machiavelli advocated cruelty and deception as the means to winning and keeping power. He is best known for his single admonition, "It is better to be feared than loved." As often happens in history, public perception had more weight than the truth. Alone, but with a cunning mind, he wrote The Prince as a treatise on power. Many assume that his intent was to prove his value as a mafia-style consigliere, like the Robert Duvall character in the Godfather movies. Although historians disagree on exactly how much of the book represents his thinking, one thing is certain. The Prince cemented the author's reputation as a cunning and treacherous political strategist. The public reaction against the book was so sharp that Machiavelli never gained the political office he sought, and he died alone in 1527. 75 years later, Shakespeare wrote about a Machiavel in Richard III, essentially meaning son of a bitch. His reputation is much the same today, someone who advocated any means necessary to win. Why, then, does Stephen Sample, former president of the University of Southern California, think so highly of him? I think more highly of Machiavelli than anyone I've ever met thinks of him, he told us. Sample, whose doctorate is in engineering, is speaking with more authority than a layperson. He has studied Machiavelli for years, both as a subject he teaches in a leadership course with leadership gurus Warren Bennis, and as a tool for leading one of the world's largest universities. His ideas about leadership, including his positive read on The Prince, became the subject of his book, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. Sample's view of Machiavelli is that in the hands of a wise person, the techniques he advocated are critical to keeping the state, we would say the tribe, strong by repelling enemies from without and from within. Here's one quote from The Prince. Well-committed atrocities are committed once, so one may establish oneself. Poorly committed atrocities are done at first sparingly, then more and more. Therefore, one taking a state must commit all the atrocities at the beginning. It reminds us of Jack Welch's early days at the helm of General Electric, when he fired so many people he was nicknamed Neutron Jack, but the company emerged stronger and healthier because of his actions. The critical question to ask about atrocities, or in a business context, tough decisions, is in service of what? We met hundreds of managers who put this passage from The Prince into service for their own promotion, the Stage 3 system. They fired the people who threatened their power, destroyed Stage 4 cultures that preached a different way of operating, and purged their departments of anyone who didn't seem loyal to them. Sample admits that Machiavelli's techniques in the hands of someone out for personal gain can be disastrous. We've seen companies destroyed by people at Stage 3 using The Prince as their Bible. Sample sees a higher purpose in Machiavelli's techniques because he's looking from the other side of the epiphany, from the perspective of Stage 4. As evidence of his tribal leader status, Sample has led arguably the most impressive academic turnaround in the history of American higher education, raising USC from a jock school to an institution where incoming test scores are among the highest in the nation, all in 10 years. In the process, he has made many tough decisions, most of which net out to the institution coming first. He leads from a clear set of values, has taken on some large egos in the university, and, although respected, has made his share of enemies. Talking about university governance, Sample said, you can get deans, provosts, even presidents, who are all about themselves and not the institution as a whole, and they lead to a rotting, a corrupting of the institution. How does he identify the people who are out for themselves? You have to listen to all the feedback, including complaints. You learn to smell it out. Sample's view that stage 3 leads to institutional decay shows that he sees stage 3 for what it is, blinding to the person and damaging to the tribe. Sample's view of Machiavelli is that in service of the institution, the prince is filled with principles that help ground the leader in a good understanding of human nature. It never occurs to this university president that people might use the techniques in service of their own egos, hence his positive view of the ancient scholar. That's not to say Sample has a naive view of people. Like most tribal leaders, Sample does see value in individual stage 3 performers. In the university setting, such individuals can bring success to the institution by winning grants and awards, even Nobel Prizes. The same is true in companies, he told us, reflecting on his service on 14 corporate boards. But Sample fumes over specific faculty, mostly in the arts, who have been nurtured by the university for years, and as soon as they make it big, it's like they're owned by the cosmos, and have always been owned by the cosmos. And when asked about USC, they'll say, "Isn't that in Los Angeles? I remember being on the campus a time or two." As is true with people who have gone through the epiphany, Sample's anger is based not on personal offense, but on a perceived act of disloyalty toward the tribes he leads. We met a tribal leader in medicine, Dr. Mark Rumens, of the Billings Clinic in Montana, who has taken Sample's advice and put atrocities into a stage 4 context. His wall has a plaque visible from the chairs in his administrative office, which reads, "The first clean kill awakens the whole herd." This sign is stunning to people who know him as a man with a soft voice and a warm demeanor, and as a person famous for his self-deprecating humor. His tone and manners convey a tribal leader's set of concerns, a love for people, empathy for their problems, and putting the institution before ego. This tribal leader makes it clear that violating rules has consequences and that he will enforce them. And we've seen him follow the adage on his wall with such unwavering conviction and resolution that it has shocked people around him. Sample has done the same, as have hundreds of other tribal leaders we've met. Glenn Esnard, a tribal leader whom we'll meet in Chapter 8, told us, "You have to publicly execute people who disobey the rules, otherwise everyone thinks you don't mean what you say, and then there's no leadership, only bullshit." What Machiavelli refers to as atrocities, Sample calls decisions you have to make for the good of the institution. Glenn, raised in the wild, wild west of Stage 3 commercial real estate, calls it doing the work of the sheriff. But notice he's on the side of tribal values, not out for his own advancement. After the epiphany, old rules are repurposed for the advancement of the tribe. Sample argues that great leaders from time to time need to use shocking methods to strengthen the tribe. In his book, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership, and in his conversation with us, he repeats the story, which he admits may be apocryphal, that after World War II, Douglas MacArthur ordered the execution of many American soldiers who had raped Japanese women. The general went so far as to invite Japanese leaders to attend the event. It was incomprehensible to them that an invading leader would execute his own soldiers for doing what soldiers had always done, he said. The action had the effect of strengthening the tribe of American soldiers and demonstrating the Army's values to Japanese leaders. While Steve Sample, Mark Rumens, Glenn Esnard, and Bob Tobias haven't executed anyone, literally, each has demonstrated that tribal leaders don't back down from difficult decisions. Their approach isn't touchy-feely and they aren't pushovers. Their focus, however, is purely on the tribe. By drawing on the tribe's convictions and values, they become more powerful than they were at stage three. End of the Epiphany. I am because we are. Once the three phases of the Epiphany have done their work, a leader's entire language system realigns. She still has an ego, but it's focused on the tribe, not on herself. I language is out, and we language is in. Dyads are being replaced by triads, which we'll examine in Chapter 10. Instead of speaking for herself and assuming that others will see the logic in her point of view, she begins to listen, to learn about the tribe, and to speak for it. As all this happens, a subtle but rapid change begins. She accrues respect, loyalty, followers, and an expectation of great things. While amassing this following, she doesn't think it has anything to do with her. Several of the tribal leaders we interviewed, including Gordon Binder, first turned us down, saying that they hadn't done anything. Binder went further. I just got out of the way and let the managers at Amgen do the right thing. We finally persuaded him to talk by pointing out that, at a minimum, he didn't stop the effort. In fact, he was an active player, but his focus on we gives the credit to others. Tobias had spent years working collaboratively with the Internal Revenue Service, rather than only filing grievances or unfair labor practice charges. His reputation as a collaborator spread throughout the government, including to then-Senator Al Gore. With a change in administration in 1992, and the election of Clinton and Gore, there was an opportunity to change the labor-management relationships in the federal government. Looking back, Tobias said, the whole idea for why we have a union changed. In 1992, I realized I could work with Clinton, which is ironic for a man who got started suing a president. He met with Gore, then vice president, and chair of Clinton's Reinventing Government program. The argument was compelling, Tobias said. You can't change the workplace that's 80% organized without dealing with the organization, unions. Tobias worked with the other federal sector union to send the vice president a proposal that he, together with the other union leaders, helped to implement as an executive order, stating that the government would work collaboratively with unions. Tobias said, then, it wasn't me speaking. It was the federal labor movement and the executive branch managers, including the President of the United States. Tobias finally found leverage with union leaders who were still using the badass model. Shortly after interviewing several people who had gone through this epiphany, we talked with Don Beck, who, after writing Spiral Dynamics, spent years in Africa. He said, after hearing about the three stages of the epiphany, there's a word in the Bantu languages that Archbishop Desmond Tutu has used to help bring the entire country of South Africa together. Ubuntu. Meaning, today I share with you because tomorrow you share with me. The word can also be translated, I am because we are. The essence of tribal leadership is building the we, and as a person does this, his influence, respect, and power increase. The Leap of Faith. Tobias describes his move through the phases of the Epiphany as a journey in which he was pulled rather than did the pulling, but he reflected that one element is required, a leap of faith. I was committing to a system I couldn't picture, he said. Somehow it just had to be better, and the allure of what I thought might be possible was enough to keep me moving. When he finally stepped down from the National Treasury Employees Union after 31 years, the last 16 as its president, it had grown from 20,000 people, mostly IRS employees, to 150,000, representing employees in 26 different federal agencies. As is common with tribal leaders, Tobias leveraged his experience and expertise, including the three phases of the Epiphany, to grow into the final stage of leadership, what we call a Stage 5 tribal elder. We'll meet up with him again in Chapter 12. After meeting many people like Tobias, we met to summarize what we were learning. A metaphor popped up in our discussion that we've used ever since. It captures the courage required to take the leap of faith into tribal leadership. Here it is. In school, when someone goes up a grade, say from third to fourth, the new grade isn't fun. There isn't as much art or painting, the old teacher is gone, as is our rapport with her. To make it worse, we see her at recess surrounded by children who aren't us. And it just feels unfair. A few months later, going back to the old grade seems unimaginably simple. We can barely believe we were challenged by the topics of third grade. Now that we're on to tougher math and harder reading, the games seem juvenile and silly. When we're ready to leave the fourth grade, we have the same feelings as we did a year before. Where this metaphor breaks down is that we don't ever have to leave Stage 3, so we get to choose to stay where it's comfortable, or to challenge ourselves and go for excellence. Whether to stay with Stage 3 or advance to Stage 4 is the single most important question for individuals and corporations around the world. As Tobias recounted the story of his epiphany, we asked what advice he would give to people still in the Wild Wild West aspect of Stage 3. His answer summarized our research and was in line with that of other experts we interviewed. I would ask what their goal is. If it's to win, keep on doing it. If it's to make a larger impact, how do you create relationships to get what it is you want them to do? You can't do it by yourself. You have to work with others. Transformational expert Werner Erhard told us that transformation begins with accepting things exactly as they are and exactly as they are not. When people see the effects of their behavior, they can make a decision, stay in Stage 3 or engage the epiphany. The choice is up to each person. Key points from this chapter. The epiphany begins with noticing that people haven't achieved what they thought, that victories they thought were tribal are only personal. As the epiphany continues, people often try to achieve group victories using Stage 3 behavior, which never works. People eventually see that the goal of Stage 3, winning on a personal basis, is self-defeating. Tribal successes, by contrast, are enduring and satisfying for everyone. Most people notice that power is a zero-sum game in Stage 3. The more you take from others, the more you have, and the less others have. By contrast, power in Stage 4 is abundant. The more you give to others, the more you get back. The last epiphany is seeing that the only real goal is the betterment of the tribe. Ironically, As people act to build the tribe, they achieve everything they sought, but couldn't achieve at stage three: esteem, respect, loyalty, legacy, and enduring success. Chapter 8. Stage 4. Establishing Tribal Leadership. David Kelly looks like an unlikely corporate hero. With a mustache, glasses, and receding dark hair, he looks as if he'd be more at home in a university. And that's exactly where he spends some of his time as a tenured professor at Stanford. His passion is collaborative design, which he and a group of friends turned into IDEO 25 years ago. By most accounts, it is the most successful engineering design company in the world. As founder and CEO, Kelly has graced the cover of Business Week, and his firm of 450 employees, technically a tribe of tribes, is credited with collaborating to create the first Apple mouse, stand-up squeeze toothpaste bottles, steel cases leap chair, rated number one by the Wall Street Journal in 2005, and the Palm 5. IDEO's physical space is built around its values of innovation, collaboration, communication, and fun. Housed in a modern building of glass and steel that incorporates the brick remains of an old auto repair shop, it is not far from Stanford, where it recruits most of its employees. The lobby waiting area features a paper table with crayons so that people waiting for meetings at the company can doodle and then rip off their work and take it with them. Lots of tall plants bordering on trees cover the inner landscape of the building. It looks like a scene from an inside park in some futuristic world, perhaps from the Jetsons. David Kelly is a tribal leader, having seen the flaws of the Stage 3 system while working in a large company. This company, IDEO, is a reaction to big Fortune 100 companies, he told us in one of IDEO's signature conference rooms, which has brainstorming rules across the top of the walls. Stay focused. One conversation at a time. Be visual. Go for quantity. Defer judgment and encourage wild ideas. As we talked with Kelly, he followed every piece of the wall's advice, except for one: stay focused. Our conversation ran from culture to IDEO's recruitment system, to the problems in higher education, to why big companies often dehumanize their employees. One theme ran through all the topics: a company is only as strong as the culture of its tribe. As is characteristic of many tribal leaders we met, Kelly ridicules many practices of corporations without ever seeming mean-tempered or judgmental. "Come, sit next to Frida and Harry," he'd say, referring to a hypothetical employee's first day in a large company. "Well, I didn't pick Frida and Harry as my friends. How come I have to have them as friends?" he goes on. "You always get evaluated by what your boss's boss does. Who wants that? I started the company because I wanted to work with my friends," he says. He described his epiphany as coming from two sources: large companies, which he learned don't work very well, and a mentor who encouraged him to write how he hoped someone would someday eulogize him. He describes what he scribbled for his mentor, written in the past tense, as a description of one who had died. "I started a collaborative, and at Christmas time, we sold stuff out of the basement. The ideas were the genesis of IDEO. We started with 10 of my friends, and all but one are still here, 30 years later. It was more build a culture than do design. We focused on what we cared about. The feeling is we are all in it together." In our research, after a person has had the epiphany that takes him from stage 3 to stage 4, he behaves differently than before. Our data shows that people tend to take one of three paths. David Kelly took the first. He gets together a group of like-minded friends and asks how they might make money. The relationships come before the business model, the tribe before the profits. If the group is composed of people who are really operating at stage 4 rather than dropouts from the system in the midst of stage 2, the ventures tend to do very well, like IDEO. The key question is, have we all owned, and are we all done with, stage 3? If the answer is yes, a small group of people becomes what we call a tribal seed. As it grows, it attracts resources, people, money, and ideas, and it flourishes into a tribe. The second path is that the newly minted Stage 4 person looks for people in a large organization, usually a corporation, nonprofit, or government, who are eager to play by a different set of rules. Often, these will be people in late Stage 3 or individuals in the process of going through the epiphany. The tribal leader collects and nurtures them and forms a tribe based on their values and aspirations. The group, often a new department or in a matrix organization, a project, becomes unusually successful, often being labeled a miracle. As the group succeeds, people at stage 3 notice the results, often trying to replicate the tribe's strategy within an "I'm great" culture. Such approaches fail, and the tribal leader's group moves further ahead, with people scratching their heads about how he does it. The third path is that the person forges out on her own, developing what we call tribal antennae, an intuitive ability to find people who can contribute to success on a larger scale than one person working alone, and who value her help in return. From the outside, her actions look like networking gone wild. She's constantly reaching out to more and more people, with others around her saying that she needs to learn focus. In fact, her actions are systematic. She is shopping for tribal members. As she finds people who fit, she networks them into the group, and a tribe slowly takes shape. Unlike the first approach, where the tribal seed determines the nature of the business from the start, this third path produces rapidly changing tribes and business models. The key to this third path is that it's not my tribe, but our tribe. The person who cobbled it together is recognized as the tribal leader, not the single visionary who calls the shots. In this system, anyone is welcome to play, and tribal members all have a hand in recruiting, provided they have something to offer and obey the rules. In this chapter, we will go through each of these three paths to see how a person becomes established as a tribal leader. We'll start with how David Kelly learned the rules of Stage 4 and how the group of friends became the most successful business in its niche. Stage 4 at IDEO. Simply put, IDEO is a company built from the tribe up. It's more important to maintain its Stage 4 culture than to win the next contract or hire the latest Stanford graduate. As we've seen throughout this book, the more it wins on the cultural front, the better its profit and loss statement looks. When you get a good culture going, it's hard to ruin it, Kelly said. When you get a bad culture, it's hard to fix. IDEO's culture has been strong since its founding more than two decades ago. IDEO not only reconceives shopping carts and re-engineers toothpaste dispensers, but also constantly refocuses how it functions as a business. Like most professional services firms, IDEO bills for its time. Although Kelly adds, we're trying to get away from that. In addition to paid gigs, the firm manufactures what it calls concept projects, which, Kelly says, bring different kinds of people together. Concept projects have included reinventing flip-flop sandals, exploring new forms of chocolate, or rethinking the modern business card. These projects accomplish the job of bringing the tribe together and getting new members up to speed. Kelly summarizes, "It's like orientation, but it doesn't seem like bullshit. We would never say we have a training program or human resources or any of that stuff," he says with a wave that is both dismissive and good-natured. "We have an orientation program where people introduce themselves to the group in weird ways. First, they have to send out an email introducing themselves. Groups of new interns might be given a fun design challenge and deliver their findings and propose design solutions by standing up and doing skits. In a program called IDEO 101, they do a revolving workshop around the country, and they do team-based things. In between, they learn about medical benefits and all that stuff. If it looks like a meeting, we don't want to have anything to do with it. But make funny hats to introduce ourselves? Absolutely." Debbie Stern, a consultant who has worked with Kelly, both at IDEO and Stanford, adds, "It seems weird to pull people out of a business to orient them. So we don't do that. We orient them here, where they work." As is typical of Stage 4 organizations, everyone seems an equal in IDEO discussions. New employees, seasoned veterans, and top people like Stern and Kelly mix together as though all play on the same soccer team. Technical note: Stage 4 tribes pay almost no attention to organizational boundaries. Palo Alto is filled with small businesses run by people who are also Stanford faculty. Some of the most innovative people we met are on loan from other profit centers in the same company. Many Stage 4 companies have contract or part-time workers, with people acting as free agents. What matters is contribution, not whether people are regular full-time employees. Kelly notes that the hardest part was getting started, even after the epiphany that a Stage 3 company was not what he wanted. "If you look at any design firm, other than a few, it's named after a person. Their name was on the door. And I started out that way, too. I started out as David Kelly Design. I figured we could get to 50 people. We're now at almost 500. Even at 50, I had to decide to give up or build the stage that others would perform on. I changed the name of the company, brought in new people, and that's how it all started." Getting a job at IDEO means convincing the tribe that the candidate will make a contribution and fit within the culture. Candidates are taken to lunch, lunched in IDEO language, by 10 employees. Kelly explains the thinking. If 10 people are emotionally committed to making that person being successful, he will be. "I say that to my friends at Google, and they say, we have to grow faster than that. But, as a private company, it works for us." For a candidate to survive being lunched means that people have to think she will succeed culturally and technically, that she will be a contributing tribal member. Note that for public companies, Wall Street's focus on short-term results can take a Stage 4 tribe off purpose. If IDEO were looking to cut its costs in the short run, it might consider streamlining its hiring system or dropping concept projects. Both actions would harm the culture and, in the long run, its profitability. Tribal leaders of publicly traded companies often act as a buffer against the short-term thinking of analysts and stock speculators. They do demand success, but they keep the focus on values, structure of relationships, and strategy, the topics of Part 3 of this book. One of the big differences between IDEO and companies that are dominated by Stage 3 thinking is that IDEO truly walks its values. Kelly says, "If we were going to measure what makes a leader here, it would be to measure how nurturing people are." Many leaders of Stage 3 organizations said similar things, but the same companies had large offices for executives and cubicles for employees, and they rated people every year according to their impact on the bottom line. IDEO, on the other hand, has, in Kelly's words, a crummy little space of your own where you have your shrine to your kids and all that, but nice furniture and cool technology in their teamwork spaces. When the early buzz about tribal leadership began to form, many company leaders asked us to help them figure out why they couldn't get any traction on teamwork. One visit to their company showed at least part of the problem. Their physical space didn't match the values of the Stage 4 tribe they wanted to be. Managers' offices lined the walls with Dilbert-style cubicles in the middle for the people who were doing the work. Many of these companies preached open-door policies and "we, not me," yet their physical design sent a different message. We believe that the future of commercial architecture must hold hands with the future of collaborative cultures, producing workspaces like that at IDEO, where the culture, values, and physical space are consistent. Griffin Hospital, from Chapter 2, shows off the best practice of giving staff a voice in creating the space, not merely delegating the decision to executives who work with designers. "We drove the architects crazy, but they were committed to the same thing we were," Griffin Hospital's Bill Pawanda said. As is typical for a Stage 4 organization, the architects had to handle input from hundreds of people. Kelly has a system for working with clients, essentially turning them into partners on IDEO projects. When IDEO partnered with Kaiser Permanente in 2003, originally to help design new buildings, the IDEO staff asked the physicians, nurses, and Kaiser managers to role-play being a patient going through their system. Everyone involved in the process saw that the problem was not a lack of facilities, but a need to rethink the patient flow process. The partnership with IDEO allowed Kaiser to develop a new sensitivity to the patient and save several million dollars by not building new buildings.